Welcome to the AFP Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Monday, January 23rd, 2023. This is the 32nd edition of the AFP Report, a podcast series where I will be interviewing reporters and contributors to American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, as well as other special guests. Please consider subscribing to American Free Press if you are not already. Subscription details can be found at AmericanFreePress.net. Today, I'm joined by Phil Giraldi, a former CIA case officer and a longtime contributor to the newspaper. All right, Phil Giraldi, welcome back to the program, sir. How are you today?
I'm fine. How are you, John?
I'm doing just fine. Thank you so much for joining me once again. It's always a great honor and pleasure to speak with you. You are a longtime contributor to American Free Press, America's last real newspaper. And you are also one of America's most honest and insightful foreign policy experts and geopolitical commentators. We just sent issue 3 and 4 of American Free Press for this year, 2023, to the printer last Friday. So right now it is being printed and mailed out to all of our subscribers as we speak. I do encourage everybody to subscribe to the newspaper if you do not already. You can find all the details at AmericanFreePress.net. And like I said, it really is America's last real newspaper, so do go out and pick up a subscription and support our work. Now, Phil, you wrote a very interesting article for issue 3 and 4, touching on a topic that is near and dear to your heart as well as mine, and that is, of course, the concept of anti-Semitism and how it is basically used to silence and delegitimize all critics or opponents of the pro-Israel lobby that at this point and for decades now basically controls the U.S. federal government. And it's also used to silence and shut down critics or noticers even of Jewish power and influence in America and the organized Jewish community more broadly and their countless organizations that operate around the country. So to get started, what exactly to you is anti-Semitism? And how is it sort of like defined by groups like the ADL and these other professional Jewish activists and their organizations?
Well, I think the quick answer to that is something that an old friend of mine, Joseph Brown, once said on that issue. He said that once upon a time, anti-Semitism was an issue for people who hated Jews. He said, but now it's become a weapon that is used by Jews for the people that they hate. So it's basically, as far as I'm concerned, the exploitation of a legitimate, although relatively unimportant issue to get a free pass on other issues. And in particular, what we see is that the anti-Semitism label is attached to people like myself. They also throw into the hopper the Holocaust denial label, which is, more of the same in terms of using a historic issue and exploiting it for a political end. Very often the political end is to defend Israel, which, as far as I'm concerned, is indefensible in terms of its human rights record.
Yes, absolutely. And those are the points that you make right off the bat in the article. And you know what? I did have a couple excerpts I wanted to read briefly, including the very first paragraph of the story. And you write here, most Americans believe the First Amendment and freedom of speech are the bedrock of all the fundamental rights protected by the Constitution of the United States. But there clearly is at least one powerful domestic group that argues that there should be exceptions to that principle, which are frequently defined as quote-unquote hate speech, to protect the actions of a foreign government. I am, of course, referring to Israel and America's most powerful foreign policy lobby, which is frequently referred to collectively as the Israel lobby. The lobby works assiduously and openly to weaponize the concept of quote-unquote anti-Semitism to justify and validate any and all Israeli behavior. And I wanted to ask you, that's a great way to open up the piece. That's the very first paragraph, as I mentioned, of your article. And I wanted to ask you, I don't know if you saw the news. It was a few weeks ago. I think it was actually either the end of December or early January of this year. There's a Jewish senator in Maryland, Ben Cardin, I believe is his name. He was testifying in some Senate committee hearing where he was basically arguing, and this man is a professional lawyer prior to him being elected to the Senate. He's up there arguing that, quote unquote, hate speech, or I'm sorry, the First Amendment does not protect, quote unquote, hate speech and anti-Semitic speech. So this is the direction that these groups and these individuals are pushing the discourse and pushing the narrative in, that, like, literally, if you say something that offends Jews or that points out their power and influence in the country and how they wield it and their overall agenda, or if you criticize Israel, then the First Amendment does not apply to you and you can be prosecuted for hate speech. That is the exact direction they want to take this in.
Yeah, and in fact, there have been bills up before Congress, none of which have yet passed, but they're still sort of sitting there, some of them in committee, which would do exactly that. They would criminalize either denying the Holocaust, whatever that is supposed to mean, and speaking in terms of criticism of Jewish individuals or groups, which they regard as anti-Semitic. And one of the interesting aspects of all this, of course, is that the U.S. Government, the State Department, for example, regards criticism of Israel as anti-Semitism. And the U.S. government has an ambassador who is in charge of the anti-Semitism office, whose responsibility is to go around the world and be looking for incidents of anti-Semitism, and again, anywhere in the world. This is the extent to which they've been successful with pushing this agenda.
Yeah, boy, that's really an incredible thing to think about, that there's literally an anti-Semitism czar. It's officially called the, and this is a point you make in the article, you talk about this, the Special Envoy to Monitor and Combat Anti-Semitism, which is literally an ambassador level position within the U.S. State Department. I'd be curious to find out what that individual gets paid every year. Right now, it's Deborah Lipstadt, the, you know, so-called Holocaust historian. Prior to her, under President Trump, it was a man named Ilan Carr, who I believe was like a district attorney in Los Angeles prior to being appointed the anti-Semitism czar. And I remember reading at the time, this was back in like early 2019 after he was officially appointed. I have a quote here directly from the Jewish Telegraph Agency where he was speaking to the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. So just to give you an idea of how organized and networked the organized Jewish community is, I mean, they literally have a Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, and that's just one of many organizations operating across the country, around the world, really, to advance the interests of Jews, or what they perceive to be the interests of Jews, and you know, the pro-Israel lobby and all these other things. And this is a quote that he made when speaking in front of this organization. He said, "My office was created by law and designed to protect the Jewish people throughout the world." Think about that. The world's greatest power is focused by law and design on protecting the Jews. And truly, think about that, folks. If you've never heard of this before, I'm sure most people listening are familiar with this position within the U.S. State Department. But we have an official position at the highest level of the U.S. government that is focused on protecting Jews and basically shutting down any criticism of Jews or noticing basic patterns and noticing basic, you know, observable facts about what they are up to, and criminalizing such actions. It's really quite astonishing.
Yeah, that's really that is kind of where we should have realized we were in a tipping point, where essentially we're becoming a government that in many aspects is being guided by Jewish power. And in this case, obviously, Jewish power is extending to the world level, where we feel that we can intervene in foreign countries based on how the Jewish lobby perceives Jews are being treated in those countries. It's just incredible. And to a certain extent, you can kind of see the tentacles of this in terms of the Ukraine war right now. There are a lot of Jews in Ukraine. A lot of the people who are involved in the politics of this war and pushing this war at State Department and elsewhere and in the White House are Jews. And it seems to me if it looks the way it looks, smells the way it smells, and you're seeing the same signals over and over again, this is something that people should begin to pay attention to.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the points you make early on in the article is how due to this basically foreign lobbying organization or organizations, it's really like a network of organizations. The U.S. federal government, certainly our foreign policy, but even domestically as well, is basically dedicated to advancing Jewish interests first and foremost. And that, of course, includes unwavering support and diplomatic support, financial support, political support for the state of Israel, even if that support of the state of Israel is actually harmful to overall U.S. interests in the region and around the world. And this is something that's been going on for a very long time. I have two more excerpts I wanted to read really quick. You say here, American political and national security imperatives in the Middle East region have been subordinated to those of Israel, while Washington provides political cover for anything the Jewish state chooses to do, and the ultimate absurdity, the American taxpayer gifts a relatively wealthy Israel with $3 billion in aid per year, plus other trade and co-production benefits that amounts to billions more. And it really would be interesting to get an accurate figure of just how much money we are giving to Israel every year. It is truly outrageous and something that most people just simply do not know about.
Well, you know, Grant Smith, whom you might be familiar with, who has been working on the pushing against the activity of the lobby in various places in the United States, most particularly in Virginia, where they have actually set up a commission in the Virginia government that exists to benefit Israel by giving them trade benefits, by giving them concessions, by giving them licenses that we ordinary Americans would not be able to get. So this kind of stuff goes on everywhere. And Grant Smith has calculated that the total benefits to Israel in a year, if you include all the tax benefits and other things that are rolled into it, would be in the nature of $12 billion.
Every single year?
Yes.
Yeah, boy, that's just outrageous. Oh, man. It's incredible to think about. Yeah, and I have no doubt. And you mentioned that even like state governments are in on this action and, you know, giving Israel special trade deals and things like that. It's just incredible, the power and influence that this one tiny minority has in our country. And you also talk about like the way they do it. And that, of course, is using this totally weaponized concept of anti-Semitism. And you talk about how Israel supporters and like other, you know, Jewish organizations operating in the diaspora and around the world use their vast wealth to buy up or leverage the media to corrupt politicians at all levels and to propagate a narrative that always depicts Jews sympathetically as perpetual victims. And you say that narrative relies on the so-called Holocaust and the slogan "Never Again" to generate the moral authority and outrage that makes the entire otherwise unsustainable imposture work, and work it does. And that's a very, very concise, excellent way of explaining exactly what they're up to and like how they use this totally ridiculous concept just to shut down any sort of criticism, or not even necessarily criticism, just open discussion, like rational, legitimate discussion of just what this powerful network of individuals and organizations truly want, right? I mean, you can't even have an honest conversation about the subject.
No, it's a trick. In fact, an Israeli minister back about 15 years ago once gave an interview in which he was completely honest, and she says, "Anti-Semitism is a trick. We always use it." So, you know.
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you're talking about. I think her name was, let me see if I can Google it really quick. I know she was a former Israeli, I think like labor minister or something like that. Mm-hmm. Okay, I found it right here. It's Shulamit Aloni. Yeah. And she said this to Amy Goodman of Democracy Now!, who's a sort of like left-wing Jewish journalist in America, and you know, the head of Democracy Now, which I actually watched like every single day when I was in college. I was like really into Democracy Now, and they do actually a decent amount of, you know, good work. But overall, I think you're not going to get the full story if you just rely on Democracy Now. But anyways, this interview was particularly revealing, and yeah, she made this epic quote that will continue to be cited and repeated and emphasized, because yeah, she basically said that anti-Semitism is a trick, and they use it, you know, in Europe. If anybody criticizes Israel, then of course they bring up the Holocaust and denounce them as an anti-Semite. In America, it's basically the same thing. So yeah, it's like in America, if you even criticize Israel, you're denounced as an anti-Semitic Holocaust denier. So that's exactly what it is. It's a psychological trick, you know, a semantics trick, essentially.
It basically rules you out of any discussion where people are wanting to be serious. You know, they're saying this man obviously is a or woman is a conspiracy theorist and is an anti-Semite and is probably a Holocaust denier, so we don't really have to talk to them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it's been effective for far too long, and it's something that I at this point, I mean, this is like the future of our country rests upon us being able to grow up and talk about these things like adults. And these people are not going to bully me or you or American Free Press or anybody else that's serious in the alternative media any longer. Yeah, there was a couple other aspects of your article I wanted to bring up. You talk about the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance and their like official definition of anti-Semitism, and how governments and other, you know, organizations and institutions around the world, including like university systems and colleges, they're actually adopting the official definition of anti-Semitism that's put out by this International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance. And it's very, I mean, if you read it, if you just Google that, Google that term, International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, you can actually pull up this page from the Jewish Virtual Library where they talk about the official definition, and it's so vague. They basically describe it as a certain perception of Jews which may be expressed as hatred towards Jews, and they list a whole bullet point list of examples of what constitutes anti-Semitism, and it's basically, you know, of course, denying the Holocaust or questioning the Holocaust. Or even like basically criticizing the state of Israel or criticizing Jews for obvious crimes that Jewish individuals commit. So, I mean, it's this vague, open-ended definition that could be applied to anybody that notices or criticizes anything that the Jews are up to.
Yeah, for example, the fact that Jews are overwhelmingly represented in financial crimes is something you're not allowed to say. That's considered anti-Semitism. That's considered something where you're completely outside the pale. The fact that Israel carries out war crimes, Israel carries out an apartheid policy within its own borders, these things are not you're not allowed to say. And that makes you an anti-Semite. You know, again, it's a trick.
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. And I would encourage anybody that is not familiar with this, just go check out this page on the Jewish Virtual Library, and it is quite Orwellian to say the least, but that's the nature of how they use this concept of anti-Semitism to trick everybody and to control and manipulate what we can and can't think. I wanted to actually bring up an article that I wrote in this current issue, the issue 3 and 4 of American Free Press, about the Anti-Defamation League's recently released results of an anti-Semitic attitudes survey that they conducted in America. Did you get a chance to read that? Or I'm sure you saw some of the headlines that came out from the ADL, and of course Jonathan Greenblatt, the CEO of the ADL, was on all the major you know, corporate news outlets talking about how anti-Semitism is rising. And the results of the survey in particular, like their main concern was that anti-Semitic attitudes among virtually all demographics and age cohorts in America were increasing and are very widespread, according to them. And of course, they always say these things. But I do think that this sort of taboo on discussing Jewish power and influence is sort of waning, however slowly. And, you know, of course, I think people like us would wish this taboo would be, done with and over with, so that we could actually have adult serious conversations about this subject. But I do think it is waning, and that certainly was reflected in the ADL's survey, which was a very, very interesting development in my mind.
Well, I would point out two things, or three things. Let me start with the ADL themselves. The ADL is basically a hate group, which essentially exists to crank up sentiments of let's call it hatred against people who are in any way critical of policies that ADL chooses to support. And some of these policies go, outside the Jewish framework. I mean, they tend to exploit blacks to a certain extent because they want it to look like they are basically a benevolent organization that's helping poorer Americans, which of course is nonsense. But the things I would point out are, first of all, the ADL itself defines what is an anti-Semitic incident. And I point out in my article that just because Palestinian students at Columbia University are having a meeting and put up a poster to that effect, and a Jewish student sees the poster and is offended, to me that's not anti-Semitism, but the ADL would count it as anti-Semitism. And the second thing is, people are not stupid, particularly, and they see that Jews are the most powerful, wealthiest, and in many professions dominant demographic, and yet they're always complaining about being persecuted and about being targeted by the anti-Semites. So there's something that's not connecting very well here. And
Right.
people see
Yeah.
that. And so people see that and they say, how do you feel about Jews? And they sort of go, and they look the other way, and they know they're not supposed to say anything, so they don't. But they don't, they see what's going on. They understand what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're like the most privileged group in America as well. I mean, you can say no wrong about the Jews in America without facing some serious repercussions. And yet they portray themselves as this like oppressed tiny minority that is just working to improve America and all this other nonsense. So yeah, people are seeing through it. And again, that was sort of reflected in the ADL's polls. But you're right. I mean, they do get to basically define what constitutes anti-Semitism. And I was looking at some of the questions that they posed to potential respondents, and a lot of them were like these sort of like vague, quote unquote, tropes about Jews. Like, do you think that Jews have too much influence in Hollywood, for example? Or do the Jews have too much influence on Wall Street? And I mean, anybody that's looked into these subjects would have to answer in the affirmative. I mean, it's pretty obvious, and Jews often brag about their influence in Hollywood or in banking. And yet, if you notice it according to the ADL, or if you sort of agree with that statement, then you have an anti-Semitic attitude and you're perpetuating an anti-Semitic trope. So the way the whole thing is even framed and surveyed itself is just designed to basically perpetuate this pre-concocted narrative.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the problem. If you defined a problem in terms that are totally defensive about your role in, what the problem is. Like, for example, when they do these questionings, say, how often do they actually ask anybody about how they perceive what Israel is doing to the Palestinians? They don't ask that question because it's self-evident that what Israel is doing to the Palestinians, which is to a certain extent being reported in our media, really has an impact on people, where they see people, teenagers being shot in the head, they see this happening and that happening, and they develop a negative perception of Israel, and Israel self-defines as the Jewish state.
Yeah, exactly. Well, to kind of wrap up this conversation, I want to talk about how people that actually have stood up to the Israel lobby, or people that have stood up and criticized Israel or criticized the organized Jewish community, or pointed out some of these inconvenient facts about them, have been totally punished and basically ran out of polite society. And that includes former senators, former representatives. You cite, for example, Senator William Fulbright and Senator Chuck Percy. as well as former congressional representatives Cynthia McKinney, Paul Findlay, Tom Tancredo, and Pete Mikulski. But this also applies at the university level. And you talk specifically about a gentleman at that was a, from what I understand, he was in line to receive a fellowship, I believe, at Harvard University, and the Israel lobby basically went after him, and Harvard didn't grant him this fellowship, but they sort of have reversed course and actually did give it to him. And the guy's name is Kenneth Roth. And this guy, Kenneth Roth, is himself Jewish, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
And, yeah, and he was the former director of Human Rights Watch, which is an organization that more or less accurately reports on the situation in Israel and Palestine and how Israel is basically essentially genociding the Palestinians and taking their land and, you know, preventing them from, you know, living productive lives, essentially. And, you know, he was basically pointing this out as director of Human Rights Watch. And that's what sort of stymied his position at Harvard. Although it seems like, you know, after we went to press, Harvard actually reversed course and did appoint him to this position, which was actually very surprising to me. This is like one of very few examples of the Israel lobby, you know, not getting their way, essentially, right?
Yeah, that's true. But of course, they only reversed course because there was significant press coverage of it in the New York Times and in other publications. And Roth, of course, is as he admitted himself after they reversed course, he admitted that, you know, this is because I was someone who was very well known, very well recognized as being having integrity. And I'm Jewish. He said I would be a lot happier if they turned around and offered a Palestinian academic who had similarly been denied a position because the Jewish lobby weighed in against him. I would like to see that happen.
Wow. So it's sort of like another example of Jewish privilege in a certain way, right?
That's precisely what he's saying. Yeah. And he, and let me quote him because he said something very interesting. He may or may not accept this position, but he's interested in writing a book, and he said he would like to look into, and this is a quote, how a relatively small group of people moves governments around the world. That's what he wants to look into. And who is he talking about? And, you know, this is, and I concluded my article basically saying, look, this is what Americans should be really concerned about. We have a 2% of the population, which dominates whole sectors of the economy, and which basically is able to shut down freedom of speech. So, you know, this is something to be seriously concerned about.
Absolutely. I mean, it is really the number one issue facing our country, I think, at this time. And it frankly has been for the past few decades, or if not longer. And it's the one topic you're just not allowed to openly discuss in polite society, even if you're doing it in a very responsible, serious, scholarly manner. And that has got to end. So really, that's I know that's a big part of what motivates you and what drives you and the subject of much of your commentary and articles and stuff. So yeah, I think we gotta keep the fight up and keep talking about this and presenting the facts in a, you know, in an objective, scholarly way, and overcome this taboo.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I say, you know, this is this all comes down to, I think, two words that you're not supposed to link together or ever use in polite speech, and they are Jewish power. Jewish
Absolutely.
Power in the United States is the issue. Now, you know, you might say, well, what does it matter? Is it different than Irish power? Yeah, it sure is. It's organized, it's well-funded, and it has objectives that are not in the interest of the United States, and that's how I would put it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And you put it very, very well, as you always do, not only in the podcast, but also in your articles. So once again, I would encourage everybody to check out American Free Press. The website is AmericanFreePress.net. And go ahead and subscribe if you're not already so you can read Phil's excellent column. And yeah, Phil, you can also check out – I know I read you often at the UNS Review as well. That's another place to find your work.
Yeah, that's correct. That would be another place. And I also post on Facebook.
Awesome. Okay, very good. All right. Well, Phil, thank you very much. I appreciate you taking the time. And we will definitely stay in touch and do this again in the future.
Okay. Well, thank you, John. It's always good to talk to you.
Okay. Take care.
Right. Bye-bye.